there's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
Big reputation. Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your biggest reputation of music news and criticism. It's me, John Caramonica.
It's a celebration today.
It is you. None of us said that.
Oh, man.
I'm so stoked, I need a toast, we do the most. I'm in the ghost like I'm whipping the boat. I got a reputation, girl, that don't precede me. I'm a call away whenever you need me. I'm on the G side, come to the A side. I got a bad bar for solo, that's what they like. You love it, I love it too, cause you my type. You hold me down and I protect you with my life.
I don't wanna touch you, I don't wanna be just another ex-love. You
know. On the Taylor Swift album Reputation, that's an endgame, but here it is just the beginning of part two of the Taylor Swift podcast extravaganza. It's Friday at around 2:45 p.m. We've all had some time to imbibe this record. The crew from last episode is back. I've got Karen Gans, Bot Music Editor.
I enjoyed it like an old-fashioned, John.
Oh, I don't know. As a teetotaler, I don't get that reference. Yeah.
What about beer in plastic cups?
Also unfamiliar.
Drunk on wine in the bathtub.
Unfamiliar.
I'll have Taylor come and explain that one to you.
I had to Google all those. Yeah. I've got Joe Coscarelli, pop music reporter.
Don't blame me.
Number one Enchanted fan.
Don't blame me.
I've got chief pop music critic, John Fareles.
I'm here.
So it's Reputation Friday. Let's give a top line feel about how you guys are engaging with this record. Because I had a little bit more time than you guys, and I went on a path.
On a journey.
I did, actually. And I will come to that, but I want to hear what everybody's
feeling. And it's even continued after you filed your review.
I would actually say it probably will continue even more before this thing is over.
Yeah.
But they're definitely, yes, I think what you're saying is accurate. Karen Gans, where you at? Joe Coscarelli, where?
No, because like my initial reaction was like, oh my God, I don't think I like this. And then the second listen, I've been telling this to people in the office, I was like, yeah, I might like this. And now I'm listening to Endgame, I Did Something Bad, and Don't Blame Me on a loop. I know Joe is going to want to talk about Don't Blame Me too. I really like that song. I like probably 70% of it.
Yeah.
And I feel, I stand behind your review. I think that you had an excellent take, John. I really do.
Well, thank you.
We don't always agree.
No.
We all know this.
No. It's a good thing there's no Kelly Clarkson feature on this record. Totally.
Especially about white female pop stars.
Well, we can get to this, but I will say, if I want to hear Kelly sing the gospel song, but we'll get there. I'm just trying to bring it back to me. Okay.
Never change, Karen.
Thank you. Yeah. It's a thumbs up.
Actually, what I'm going to do moving forward on the podcast every week is I'm going to give you the opportunity, no matter what we're talking about, to come in for 30 seconds and say which song on the album you would like Kelly Clarkson to sing.
I can do that.
It'll just be like a running bit. Like, we'll be talking about, like, Sepultura, and you'll just, like, come in.
If you were talking about Sepultura guitars, you know, I'll be here, Don.
Oh, that's true. You'll already
be
here.
Yes, I'll be here.
So when you tell me which Playboy Cardi song you would like Kelly Clarkson to sing, I would like
to know.
Fair.
That's
okay.
Fair.
So just coming soon on podcast.
But also coming soon, Ashley Simpson. But
end of year special. I'm getting your emails. It's coming.
We are listening. But before you pass to Joe, who's sitting to my left, I like it.
Good.
I'm just going to say that.
It.
Move along.
I'm not a critic. John, I thought your review is very good. The word jarring, which I believe appears
like
in
Trump
it.
Like a Trump cabinet meeting.
Tell me more about you use the word jarring, which was, how I felt initially. I think, you know, anyone who knows me or who has seen me speak or dancing tweet or of. Tumble about Taylor Swift. I'm an old Taylor head. Pop Taylor has always confounded me a little bit. And this album didn't change that, but it's sort of like, I understand where you've gone with your life, old friend, and I accept it.
Wow.
I don't
deeper any, take than mine.
Here's the thing, any old friends in my life about whom that has happened, right. They're canceled.
I know. So I say that as a fan, not a professional, but it's starting to come together for me as an album. I think there's a lot of bangers. I think the rollout of the album was a little odd, and we can talk about moving forward. I don't feel like it gave me a good sense of this, so I'll say I was pleasantly surprised, and I'm still learning.
John Perales.
It's growing on me. I'll say that.
Lichen?
A little faster than lichen. No, my first impression was, wow, she's borrowing every trick from everybody she can think of. Mm. She, you know, where's Taylor Swift in this? I'm starting to hear her wordplay in some of the lyrics. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to hear her melodic lines.
Yep. There aren't that many, but they're there.
Under the vocoder, the vocal effects.
Under the rapping.
Yes.
I'm still hearing a lot of craftsmanship and a pop star that I don't think I want to get to know that much better.
A bunch of snakes in your mentions, JP.
But she's happy to be abrasive. You know, she's good definitely.
Point. Well, I think this is the album where super, she embraces that
point.
Idea.
Super good point.
Yeah.
Although I think it's always been there. JP, also before I start talking, did you like my review also?
Yes.
Okay, just checking. I just want to make sure.
He tweeted about it last night.
Yes, he did. I saw. But I didn't, the people may not know.
Yeah, to complete the circle.
I don't know what the overlap between JP Twitter followers and podcast listeners are. I don't know.
It's probably pretty high.
It's probably a circle as a Venn diagram. Okay, so almost every song has, it's like these left turns and then right turns, soft into hard into soft. And it's
hard
happening.
Into harder.
Yeah, right. Seriously. True story. And I found that quite a lot to take in. It was a lot to chew. And I felt for me, on like first gloss, it was hard to appreciate the things that JP, that you were just talking about, which is like the craftsmanship, the songwriting turns, the good melodies, where melody is important. And frankly, on a lot of these songs, melody is not that important, which is interesting. But as I let it kind of like seep in and put closer ears on it, again, it was that existential shift of like, is this working as a Taylor Swift record to is this working as a record that happened to have been made by Taylor Swift?
The first listen, you're sort of like, what is she doing? And then the second one is like, why is she doing this? And then you're like, okay, fine. Fine.
Can I read a tweet?
Yeah.
That I got from a guy who I think was insulting me, but I think kind of like was right. I'm just saying.
Well, of course you can.
If you wrote this tweet, you know who you are, but I'm not going to give you any shine. The entire review makes the case that Swift has lost what made her unique and jumped onto trends that have the effect of losing her unique voice. But it says that's a good thing. Huh? All facts.
Yeah, that's accurate. You did say that.
Also, I feel like this person accomplished in one, say, 200 character tweet what probably took me like 1,200 words to do. So, like, good for you.
Maybe we should retweet that from the music account. I'll look for it.
This is now the official New York Times review. But that is very much how I felt, because one of the things that's so, to me, almost like DNA level elemental about Taylor are the sort of color of her narrative and the strength of her melody. You never think of Taylor as a powerhouse singer. You don't necessarily think of her as an innovator. You think of her as someone who has certain songwriting fundamentals, like extremely down cold. And when you approach these new songs, you don't necessarily get that. And I actually was thinking, I had forgotten how much I initially didn't like the song with Zayn from the—
I Don't Want to Live Forever.
Yes.
I love that song.
I like it somewhat now, but I initially did not like it, and for many of the same reasons I initially struggled with some of the songs on this record.
Well, and it's interesting because that was the first taste of Taylor that we got with sort of like trappish drums and, you know, like darker synths.
That's the prelude.
That's this album. But I think what you're getting at about moving away from the little things she was good at, I do think that there are more generic moments on this record and songs that, as we said on the last podcast, like could be sung by other pop singers of the moment. But I think the reason it works is because every song that's good has those little Taylor moments in it. And I think, you know, we talked about the chorus for Ready For It. Every piece of this album that is working for me, at least, you know, she comes through with one little vocal run or one little phrasing or one lyric that sets her a cut above.
Excepting New Year's Day, which is like obviously the outlier on this record. I will say, in addition to your point, I'm surprised at how effectively she chameleoned her way into some of these styles that are not natural to her. And to make that point, let's listen to Delicate. Dive bar on the east side, where you at? Phone lights at my nightstand in the black. Come here, you can meet me in the back. Dark jeans and your Nikes, look at you. Oh damn, never seen that color blue. Just think of the fun things we could do. Reputation's never been worse, so you must like me for me. Yeah, I want you. We can't make any promises now, can we, babe? But you can make me dream. Is it cool that I said all that? Is it chill that you're in my head? Cause I know that it's delicate. Is it cool that I said all that? So here's my real question about Delicate, is which rapper is going to get on Delicate?
I mean, Delicate it's a big tune.
It's honestly, so is it Drake? Is there a Playboy Barty remix coming of Delicate? Is that going to happen? 21 Savage?
It's a great beat.
It's honestly legitimately great and would be seamless with like any number of kind of like, I don't want to say post-lyrical because some of these guys are lyrical, but people who rap in a less conventional, less structured way.
Is that one of the Max songs?
It is a Max Martin Shellback song. So we didn't mention this, but the album is produced almost entirely by a small group of people.
8 or 9 out of the 15 songs are Max and Shellback or Max Shellback plus one.
Mm-hmm. Someone named Oscar. There's two Oscars.
And then the rest are Jack with Taylor. Yes. Taylor does not get production
Jack
credits.
Jack Antonoff, that is.
Yeah, sorry, Jack Antonoff. Taylor gets production credits on those songs, and she executive produced the album.
She did.
But she does not get producer credits on the Max songs.
Right, and which is interesting because Max Martin executive produced 1989, and you see her sort of taking that throne, being like, I apprenticed in making a pop album, and now it's my turn.
So do you guys feel like keeping a close circle and not kind of reaching out to a wider range of producers, is that actually an effective choice?
Well, the thing is, if you use the same producers that everybody else uses, you're playing in their sandbox, but you're going to get a record that sounds like everybody else's record. I mean, and that's the thing that I go back and forth on this record. It sounds like a lot of other people's records because she's working with the same people who, despite their incredible talent, have some limits on their creativity. I mean, Max Martin's really smart because whenever he's getting stale, he gets a new collaborator. And the new collaborator shakes things up, shakes it off, and so his music keeps changing. It's not like the guy with the formula. But still, if Lorde is using the same songwriters and Selena Gomez is using the same songwriters and Katy Perry is using the same songwriters, it does make your radio station a little homogenous.
It is somewhat notable to me, you know, I don't mean to keep harping on her early career, but Taylor is the only Taylor is the only woman who worked on this album who's credited as a writer or producer.
Yes.
Last album was similar, clean. She wrote with Imogen Heap.
Imogen, yeah.
And there's a lot of Imogen Heap on this album, I would say.
Hiding in plain sight.
But I will say, you know, I miss Liz Rose. I don't know what their situation is. She was Taylor's earliest co-writer. Yep. She did Tim McGraw. She did Fearless. You Belong With Me. The last song she did with Taylor, All Too Well. Just saying.
Oh, wow. Joe literally looks like the shrug emoji right now. Like he has. I think it might have been based on you.
So just, you know, I think Taylor's going to have a long career. I think she's going to go
in
a lot of different directions. But I'll be very interested to see when she makes an album with majority women. I think it'll take us to a different place.
I'm going to snip this part of the conversation and put it in a time capsule. And then when that happens, like 3 to 9 years
from
now.
Yeah, I'll see you at the Grammys.
Real talk.
I feel slightly shamed that you noticed this and I didn't.
You know, we're all feminists at this table, Karen Gates.
It's true.
But back to Delegate. Okay, so Delicate, I think, has become probably my favorite song on this record.
And I'm seeing it get a lot of fan love.
Is that true?
Okay. In the streets, too.
Great.
It's also one of the most old Taylor songs on the album.
But she's kind of rapping, but
the lyrical conceit
is absolutely.
I mean, it's how she's
You mean tonal, thematically and tonally.
Yeah.
But then she delivers it in this very modern way. And so, okay, so I have a couple questions. Who is Taylor's rap coach? Because when I listened to this song, I was really listening to the patterns. And I was like imagining how Taylor of 2010 or 2012, because this was, you're right, because a lot of those lyrics felt like older Taylor lyrics. And I was like, how would this have sounded on Speak Now, this lyric? How would this have sounded on Fearless? And I kept imagining where she would like go high and where she would kind of like pause for dramatic effect. But it's not like that. It goes like that. Like it's done.
It actually flows.
Right. So where's that from? Who taught her?
We'll say the Big Reputation flow. That's from Drake Up All Night with Nicki Minaj. That's a little reminiscent there. Mm-hmm. I think there are some Drake moments on this album.
Of course.
I think there's some Noah 40 Shabib moments on this album.
Yes.
A little drum influence. Mm-hmm. But yeah, her cadences, you know, I think they work most of the time. She's
largely avoiding, and this I talked about this in my review, because obviously what you have on this album that you have not previously had on Taylor Swift album is her engaging with black music, whether it's hip hop abstractly or like soul notionally, because Taylor doesn't have a voice that can actually echo soul music, and she's not trying to pull an Iggy Azalea, but she is engaging with those styles. And I think that kind of like three layers of remove where it's like, I'm not working with an actual rap producer, but I'm working with like Max Martin's idea of what like a Drake producer might do.
Well, I think you made that point. I remember you making that point about 1989, which is that it was basically the only album at that period that was pretending like black music wasn't the dominant form of American pop music, basically. And I think it's interesting that her collaborators here, Max Martin and Jack Antonoff, are basically the firmament of what remains of like white American pop, and you know, going back to our Pink Kelly Clarkson, like that.
Have you read my Nothing Nowhere profile? Curious. Put that out there. Yo, when they collab on the next record, it's over.
Yes.
I feel like that could happen.
Yeah, I feel like probably.
But like I said, I just remember you making that point about 1989, and that
so
stuck
glaring.
With me, and now it's no longer true.
How many years has it been?
Three years. Lots changed in those 3 years. Then, of course, the counter argument to that is here, you know, there's obviously, is Taylor appropriating this? Is she da da da? I think, in my feeling, she's trying to create enough distance in order to avoid those charges. If they sat down before making those songs, I would venture to say that was the conversation that they had.
I think there are a few inelegant moments where that gets lost.
You mean where she's like, talking rhythmically?
Yeah.
Yeah, although to be fair, I was listening to a Nav song earlier, and it's like, I don't know, man.
On balance, she was very careful about this, but I do think there's a couple of moments where it slips.
Yeah, I think yes. Say it's 70-30 or 75-25.
I guess we need to listen to Don't Blame Me Now.
Okay. Yeah, that was good.
Because of this conversation.
We do.
Joe, do you want to open the door so the choir can come in?
Yes.
Don't blame me, love. Made me crazy if it doesn't. You ain't doing it right. So win it right. Lord, save me. My drug is my baby. I be using for the rest of my life. Oh, don't blame me, love. Made me crazy if it doesn't. You ain't doing it right. You ain't doing it. Oh, Lord, save me. My drug is my baby. I be using for the rest of my life.
So we rented out a 30-piece gospel choir.
So let me just say, if Taylor doesn't bring the choir to SNL or to the Grammys in February and destroy this song with a big vocal accompaniment, someone will have not done their job.
Okay, so I know that we all take turns creative directing Taylor's career. I understand that's like part of the job. It's just part of what we do. Before we do that, though, Karen, as the preeminent Madonnaist on the panel.
It's tough. John's right here.
Paralysis is pointing at Karen. He's a humble man.
Okay, as the only person who voluntarily still goes to Madonna shows.
I think John would.
I voluntarily.
Yes, there you go. See?
Five nights in a row?
No.
Okay. So I'm tossing to Karen.
Yeah, no,
I'm tossing
to Karen.
So when I heard this song, obviously I'm thinking of, you know, 88, 89, that era of Madonna. And I'm thinking how well Madonna did it. And I'm thinking how, like, by comparison, how toothless this felt, even though I like the record. But I'm like, there's a way to do this and do it well.
I think what works is the melody. And, like, weirdly, I don't mind the lyrics, but the drug is my baby, I'll be addicted for the rest of my life. Is that the line?
Mm-hmm.
I've only listened to it a few times today. I don't know. Maybe it's gotten in my head.
My eyes twitching.
I like that phrasing. You know, it's inverted.
It's a very common pop trope, but, like, I like the way that it appears here. And I think the melody is strong. I mean, her voice is not a choir voice. It's thinner. She does go for a little blow at the end there.
Which is what I'm saying. If she sticks that landing live, all will be forgiven by all the doubters.
I'm sure she's vocal training as we speak for that. But yeah, no, there is something, and this might not even be an appropriate segue, but there's something about Madonna, you know what I mean? Well, you're about to find out what I mean. That there is more of an embodiment of sexuality and power in Madonna's voice. Even though she doesn't have the best voice, you know, always. I take it back, Madonna. You know I love you.
Oh, my God. Wow.
After
she got vocal trained for Evita, her voice changed. I think we can all agree. But this was pre-Evita. Sorry.
Really love this tangent.
This
is as jarring a left turn as it's happening about nine songs on this record.
You got in the car. You drove me here. And now you're mad at me.
Is it a getaway car?
Yes, it is a getaway car. Nice. It's the end game here, guys. There are moments on the record, I think this is part of it, where the religion and the sexuality and the soul intersect with Madonna, they do not with Taylor, and that might be a flaw of that song.
Does that mean she's singing with her hands tied?
She could be singing, but it could also
enough,
mean...
Enough.
But also, it's my favorite song on the record right now.
It is.
Yeah, it is. I really love it.
It's mine, too.
Okay. Talk about what?
It's just big, and it's the biggest reach I feel like she makes stylistically because of everything you guys have said in the last few minutes, and yet somehow she pulls it off. Also, like, you know, I'm just a sucker for gang vocals, like whether it's like pop punk or Creek Boys, it just works for me every time.
Sure.
I also like that it doesn't sound like the way we were discussing about she was appropriating other bits of like contemporary pop and working it in. Yes. Like, this doesn't sound particularly like what's on the radio right now.
It's not.
It's like a big ear change when you hit it, and it's pleasing.
Though Craig Jenkins at Vulture in his review likened it to Dangerous Woman, the Ariana Grande song, which I feel like it has.
That's fair.
Ariana is also a singer very much in that vein.
Yes, totally. and a singer in the way that Taylor is not.
Yes, but also I don't think of Ariana as like a current pop star in the way that I think of like a Halsey or Selena.
Totally.
And it's worth talking about. Let's maybe take a minute and think about the bigger picture, because in my review, and I think we all sort of see eye to eye on this, she's borrowing both from the sort of Drake and post-Drake lineage, but she's also borrowing from the kind of like bad young women of pop, kind of like your alt heroes of contemporary pop.
The black swans of contemporary pop.
Sure, yeah. And so it's been striking to watch that particular movement. We talked a little sort of about the Drake stuff, but it's been interesting to watch that movement kind of arise and feel very much post-Lord. I don't know that we've seen post-Taylor, except Kelsey Ballerini and maybe in country you see post-Taylor. But in pop, I don't know that we've seen post-Taylor. Lord actually seems to have created the more viable lane for 16 to 20-year-old singers to try to, like, follow. Is Taylor moving in that direction, an implicit acceptance of the fact that that is the dominant sound and that this movement actually has cachet in a way that Taylor making an old Taylor record in 2017 might just not actually get off the runway?
I feel like it's a hard question to answer. I mean, I think you made a good point. I don't know if I have anything to add.
Okay. JP?
There's some Lorde on this record, too.
Oh, definitely.
Where she does the fast verse and the slow chorus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and some Jack Antonoff.
Yeah, I mean, this is where when you're sharing producers, those ideas are going to, like, find different ways to filter in.
But I think subject matter-wise, we're talking sonically. I think subject matter-wise, it is a more conscious shift. I mean, this is, as you write, and as is obvious on first listen, she says a bad word, she does a bad thing, and Karen alluded to this, it's the most sensual, sexual Taylor album.
Karen,
do you want to aim for that?
Karen, you seem like, yeah, Karen, you, I feel like what you're saying, even though you're not saying it, is you want to hear Dress. How about this? Let's not play Dress, because I don't want Karen to get up and walk out midway through
the
podcast.
But this is a sex and drinking album.
Let's play I Did Something Bad.
There we go.
That's a good one.
I never trust a narcissist, but they love me. So I play them like a violin, and I make it look oh so easy. Because for every lie I tell them, they tell me three. This is how the world works. Now all he thinks about is me. I can feel the flames on my skin, crimson red paint on my lips. If a man talks shit, then I owe him nothing. I don't regret it one bit, cause he had it coming. They say I did something bad, then why's it feel so good? They say I did something bad.
Why does that feel so good?
You know what? It actually really does.
It does.
It's a very satisfying song to listen to.
Yes.
Yeah.
She'd do it over and over again, to be fair.
How do you guys think?
but here you have someone praising how manipulative she is. Here you have someone, I mean, do you really want to be with this person?
I don't think we have to deal with that question right now. Sounds like Taylor is very much in love.
I take the fifth.
This is the best podcast ever.
But how do you guys think the things change if this is the first song we hear from the album?
Okay, see, I think this might have been a better first song. I'm not sure it radically changes. I think if Getaway Car was the first, like, you know, then that's a different story. I did something bad to me. I just think that does kind of what Ready For It does, but with more narrative power.
Right. And I guess I'm just thinking of this idea that of reclaiming her sort of villain thing, the whole snake emoji thing, which seemed like it was going to be a big part of this album, ends up being 40%.
I would say even
thematically.
And it's
front loaded, right, on the album. It's mm-hmm. side A is more about
this is why we can't, and it
comes back here and there, but it doesn't flow through the entire thing, I think.
And I think to your point about rollouts, if you advertise that really what this is about is I'm taking out all my enemies, you can't clown me, I clown me, and I don't clown I clown me with grandeur, and I do. Then you come with an album that's like basically like I broke up with one guy and then there was another guy. I picked another guy and then maybe I broke up with that guy and then there's a third guy.
But that, I think it's three guys.
That's what it sounds like.
It's either two or three.
It sounds like three.
But like most of it, is about that. So from a, you know, I don't know what the marketing meetings are like, but like I don't know if someone raised their hand and was like, is it weird to sell this album as like a revenge record when actually it's like a breakup? I'm basically taking shots at myself for my misbehavior, but then I find love.
But I think the best songs lyrically do both, like Delicate, which we played earlier, you know, has the my reputation's never been worse, mm-hmm. but basically the idea being you don't care.
Right. You love me for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's where
therefore,
the themes
you two are a broken
come
soul.
Together. I've been playing this game in my head, which was if if she needed to come with Kanye shots on the first song, mm-hmm. what if it was This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things?
Should we listen to that? Let's listen to the Kanye parts of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things.
Here's a toast to my real friends. They don't care about that. He said, she said. And here's to my baby. He ain't reading what they call me lately. And here's to my mama. Had to listen to all this drama. And here's to you. Cause forgiveness is a nice thing to do.
I can't even say it with a straight face.
This is why we can't have no.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
So I want to say, sitting at this table, I feel like I'm surrounded by friends. But Taylor,
do you feel very Gatsby?
all that year. But Taylor's implying that some person, perhaps Kanye West, has been losing friends at a prodigious clip. That's a sub. And maybe he's accurate, maybe not. Like, I don't know if Jay and Taylor are texting and they're just like, oh, you know, I just don't even talk to him anymore.
You know what? If it's between this and the first single, I think the first single is kind of like, I don't know. I think it's more successful than maybe we're giving it credit for, because it was such a hard reset.
Yes.
And it became a news event. I don't think that any of these other songs would have accomplished that. The spoken word part of that one with the old Taylor being dead, it's like Showgirls. It's so bad, it's good.
Well, and Jack Antonoff has said that people don't appreciate the camp.
I think it's hilarious. And this is why we can't have nice things. Yeah, totally. She's pushing her down the stairs right now. This is why we can't have nice things. It's in the like last Friday night, goofy, campy Katy Perry zone. Mm-hmm. And I don't find it that it has teeth, except for this weird moment where Taylor like laughs. Like this,
she says she forgives him, and then she laughs.
Like, a forced fake laugh that she can't even say it because it's so funny to her.
And it's almost saying LOL. Well, right?
I think it undoes all the goodwill of the entire song and all the fun and playfulness of it, and maybe even the whole record for me. I have to skip the song because it makes me so angry.
Here's another thing about This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things that I think is a reason why it would not have worked in this role. When I heard this song, and especially the chorus, and especially the vocal tone she uses in the chorus, that feels like 2012 Taylor to me.
Totally.
And obviously, it's interesting. I wrote this whole review about Taylor pilfering ideas, and the one thing that I forgot to mention is she's pilfering from herself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she's pilfering from 2012 and 2014. And I just neglected to include that. But when I heard this, I was like, oh, this is 2012 Taylor. So even though the sentiment and the subject matter is very current, the way she approached it is not.
I also just think lyrically it's more piercing to me than Look What You Made Me Do for Kanye.
Sure.
And I think it's very infantilizing when she says, you know, this is why we can't have nice things because you break them. So yes. I have to take them away.
Yeah.
And that reminds me of the last song that she allegedly wrote for Kanye, Innocent, which also has this like thick layer of condescension.
Yes.
In it. And I feel like if we're taking shots at Kanye and the point is to pierce him, I feel like this one accomplishes it.
In a way that the other one doesn't.
Yes. No,
and also, well, to be fair, part of the reason that the other one doesn't do it quite in the same way is because it came first and it, like we discovered this,
yes.
that was thrust upon us.
Right.
So I think maybe if we had arrived at that, we might feel differently about it.
Well, also, look what you made me do is just sort of like you've turned me into a dark, evil, you know, like vindictive person. And this is why we can't have nice things is like, you're the problem.
But also part of the punchline of look what you made me do is I did something bad is basically like those things that are basically the universe has thrust her towards. She's actually like, you know what? And I know that I did something bad. It's about alcohol. Mm-hmm. And it's about who knows what else.
A lot of these songs are about alcohol.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe all that booze is the country connection.
Mm.
Okay. Wow, that's like a good full circle.
Yeah, which she never sang about.
This is her Hank. So you're saying this is her Hank Williams record?
Yeah, this is her Hank Williams record. Well, I was thinking Getaway Car. She could have sold that one to Little Big Town.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, she did sell a song to Little
she
Big
was,
Town.
You know, no. Better Man won CMA Song of the Year just a couple days ago.
So you think Getaway Car is another one?
I mean, Getaway
one that
Car is basically
country.
Is an old Taylor country song with
turned into a bleacher song by Jack Antonoff.
I want to spend a little more time on Getaway Car, but before we leave Boyfriends totally behind, I'd like to travel, I guess, close to Scotland.
Sure.
I think are they connected? I don't know. I lived in England for 2 years. I should know this. Anyway, let's go to Scotland. Let's talk about Calvin Harris. I have a theory. Can I share a theory with you guys?
Adam Wiles.
That's his government?
I think so.
Okay. Can we play a little bit of Dancing with Our Hands Tied?
I loved you in secret. First sight, yeah, we love without reason. Oh, 25 years old. Oh, how were you to know when my love had been frozen? Deep blue, but you painted me golden. Oh, and you held me close.
Okay, so I want to say I have an incredibly vivid memory of the first time that I heard Dear John. Dear John is the savage dismantling of John Mayer, written and performed by Taylor Swift in the manner of a John Mayer song.
Guitar licks and everything.
It is astonishing. It is honestly one of my favorite songs of the last 15 years. It's incredible. It's impeccably executed. It is Taylor at her meanest, at her most vindictive,
and most and vivid writing,
and most wounded. It is that perfect intersection of victim and assassin. Love that song. I believe Dancing with Our Hands Tied is the Dear John of the Calvin Harris relationship. Except here's the problem. Calvin Harris is completely undistinguished as a musician, has very little to offer by way of narrative, and the types of other dancey records that Taylor is making are basically all dancey records that could have been made by Calvin Harris or could have been made by Zedd or Kygo or whoever. Like, you know, like one chain smoker, probably not even both, just one chain smoker. So that's my theory. I would like to hear from everybody. if anybody's got a vibe on that, either in the room or out in the world, send us an email.
I think you're right.
Totally agree.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I felt really excited when I arrived at that. I think, and I have not seen anybody else talk about
the
that
the soft synths, the sort of mellow drop in the chorus, and the repeating dancing, dancing, dancing as the drums and synths are fighting one another. I think that is as much of a Calvin Harris reference as you can get. She says that some man turned her bed into a secret oasis, which, as I told John in a text message, just reminds me of Coachella, which, you know, I'll take that as a Calvin Harris sub as well.
That's hilarious.
I want to say, before we finish with that, imagine being parodied, but having such an undistinguished style that
you can't tell it's parodying.
You can't actually tell that someone's parodying you.
Honestly, I was listening to this song waiting for her to say feels, because then it would have functioned as both a Calvin diss and a Katy Perry diss.
Thorough.
I don't think there's much Katy dissing on this album.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe a couple subs.
Half a bar.
Yeah, if that. But that's the biggest bar, is that you don't even get a bar. So let's now circle back and let's listen to a bit of Getaway Car right now. And then when we come back, we are going to be taking your questions.
It was the best of times, the worst of crimes. I struck a match and blew your mind, but I didn't mean it. And you didn't see it. The ties were black, the lies were white. In shades of gray and candlelight, I wanted to leave him. I needed a reason. X marks the spot where we fell apart. He poisoned the well, I was lying to myself. I knew it from the first, old-fashioned, we were cursed. We never had a shotgun shot in the dark. You were driving the getaway car. We were flying, but we never get far. Don't pretend it's such a mystery. Think about the place where you first.
This is probably my second favorite song on the record. This and Delicate kind of like are jousting for first place. I think the songwriting on this feels the most Old Taylor. And by Old Taylor, I mean emotionally authoritative, texture details, interesting turns of phrases, and kind of like things that make an unexpected left but don't jolt you. Just kind of like gently like pull you in a unexpected direction. I think it's beautiful. JP, you're into it too.
Yeah, I like it too. The way the metaphors bounce between actual love on the rebound and robbery. It's pretty clever.
Is it love on the rebound or is it cheating?
Mm. Well, that's alluded to throughout the album, right? I have a boyfriend. He's older than us. He's in the club doing I don't know what.
Neither do any of us because his records are undistinguished.
Or maybe Hiddleston was in the club. We don't really know. Chronologically.
Like a hunting club, maybe. A fox hunt club, maybe.
one thing I'll say about Getaway Car that also is both country and harkens back to Old Taylor is the final chorus switch where at first he's driving the getaway car and then she's driving the getaway car.
Going back
to our song, that's a classic.
And to be fair, was a real country trick of the late 90s to mid 2000s, the kind of shifting narrative perspective still happens a lot, but it doesn't happen quite as much because everybody's too busy. Well, frankly, being a gentleman and respecting women. So you can't shift narratives when you just have to respect the entire time. There's no narrative shifting. But that was a thing that happened a lot in the late 90s and early 2000s, and I think informed Taylor's songwriting for sure.
And it's the plot twist at the end of Dear John,
Should we just listen to some Dear John?
Wrote him a song.
Pedro, we're going to put some Dear John in here.
Once revolved around you,
counting my footsteps, praying the floor won't fall through again. When my mother accused me of losing my mind, but I swore I was fine. You paint me a blue sky and go back and turn it to rain. And I lived in your chess game, but you changed the rules every day. Wondering which version of you I might get on the phone tonight.
Oh, okay. Now that we've all picked ourselves up off the floor after that haymaker of a record, Getaway Car, in addition to me liking it a lot, like I also found very reassuring, because there was still part of me that, even though I enjoy these records, I enjoy this album, there's still part of me that's like, oh, this is not why I used to like Taylor. This is me liking Taylor for another reason. And there are other artists who have done that over the course of their career, notably Kanye West, who shows up in different forms and like manages to pull you with him. And that's striking. You know, I'm not saying this is her Yeezus, even though there are one or two songs that sound like they could have been on Yeezus, but it's notable that she took a risk in how she presented herself and more or less pulled that off. That's not something that a lot of her peers are doing.
Another Yeezus parallel is the sort of, you know, you have a foggy, tumultuous journey and then the clouds part and you have Bound 2, or you have New Year's Day.
New Year's Day. Okay, so we're going to run through some questions. You guys came through with a lot of good ones, and some we'll spend a lot of time on, and some we'll speed round. All right, so the first one that I'm going to read is from Alex Gerard. Alex has two questions. Well, the second question is about Taylor's use of rap, which I feel like we've talked about. Here's the other question, and this might be more of a Joe Coscarelli question and maybe a John Caramonica question. Do you think the change in style between 1989 and Reputation is more significant than the change between Red and 1989? I think 1989 did a great job of moving Taylor completely away from the country scene without alienating those fans. Do you think the fans she'd built up through her first four albums stick around for Reputation, or is this too far?
To start from the end, I think the fans stick around. I think
there's no doubt about
it. I don't think she's lost many fans in any of this. And I think
she has her own army.
Right. And I think she's done a great job of tying every album back to the last one. I think Red had just enough country influence. There's a lot of guitar on Red, you know, All Too Well, which we've mentioned is on Red. And then I Knew You Were Trouble, you know, and 22 and We're Never Ever Getting Back Together are when she, you know, first really got into her Max Martin universe. And then 1989, you have Max and you have Jack.
I probably should have written a thing about how The Weeknd going to Max was basically Taylor going to Max.
I was going to say, I think that Max was probably influenced by his work with Abel and brought that 100%. To this Taylor project.
100%.
But I think then that like the Jack songs on this album sort of take us back to 1989. So I'd say she's been very meticulous about keeping it even. I think the steps between albums are all equal, I would say. Yeah, and that goes back to even Self-Titled to Fearless, I think.
Sure.
She was careful about having bits of both worlds.
I think I have a slightly different answer. I feel like from a pure style perspective, I think the leap from 1989 to here is greater. But I think I want to say risk, although it's nothing's really risky here, but like in terms of relative risk, I think from Red to 1989 is the bigger conceptual. Because it's like, I'm going to go in for a full, more or less a full album of this with a
stadium tour that's a pop spectacular.
Yes,
country show.
Good point. And that, I will say, the energy of the 1989 tour was very different than the energy of the previous tours. And I don't know if it was as successful, because I don't know if she was as comfortable
doing the,
delivering
the choreographed
a pop
dance.
But I think that was part of why they constructed so many gimmicks for the tour, right? There was a special guest every night, and it kept people interested in
and
it.
And there was a lot of
Joan
set.
Baez! Yeah. I know all you kids
the
came
night
to
I went, the entire United States Fetty Wap soccer team was there.
How'd they sound?
I think I had Chris Rock and either Joey or Chandler from Friends. I can't remember which one. This was in LA.
That would actually be fire if they were just all on different dates. Yeah. And here's Lisa Kudrow. I know you kids have been waiting for that. So anyway, that's my vibe. I think there was a little bit more risk last time.
Well, but and that was putting down the guitar, really.
Yes.
I think. Like,
well, that was every headline could be Taylor Swift goes pop for that record.
Okay, here's another question. It's a quick one from Brian Levine. Is it just a coincidence that Ready For It references / samples in quotes Kanye's I'm In It? Is that the ultimate shade?
Well, it doesn't sample it, right?
No, it samples in quotes.
Okay.
Yes, no, it doesn't sample.
It
but
references it.
Yes, yes. It conceptually samples it.
I think it's shady.
You don't think it's a tribute?
I mean, I'm, is it possible it's neither?
I think it's coincidence. I honestly, it sounds so similar, and I get what you're saying, and I think it works as shade, but I just don't imagine Taylor or Max Martin sitting around listening to I'm In It, but
speculative
knows?
Question, has Taylor listened to Yeezus?
That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
I don't know. Especially
I'm not
on
sure.
In It, which is the foulest song.
Yeah, I don't know.
She is such a student.
You think she's listening to Hold
Scholar.
My Liquor?
Well, but this is what I was thinking this morning. I want to know if she's heard Codeine Crazy or Throwaway from Future's catalog.
Glad you brought up Future, because there is a question that is Future related here. This is coming from Hannah Doyle, and Hannah Doyle literally came through with like 6 questions. So,
shout out to you, Hannah.
Shout out to you. I'm just going to run through. It starts with Future, but then I'm just going to run through. Why do you think she collabed with Future? Do you think it was to be associated with his reputation or for other reasons? That's one. 2, she won a CMA 2 days before her poppiest album yet. Do you think Taylor will continue to keep a hand in the country music cookie jar? 3, now that she's asking to be compared to other pop stars, how does she actually stack up? Does she bring anything new to the table? And then 4, open-ended, is the old Taylor really dead? So let's start with Future. Okay, so I have theories that are music industry theories, and I have theories that are like artistic theories. I'll give the artistic one. Earlier today, in preparation for our weekly playlist, I was going through the Spotify new music Friday stuff, and there was some song that had a Future verse on it. I can't remember what it was. And I listened to it, and I was like, wow, this is like finding a 2017 penny. I don't think it has any value or meaning anymore. And it's not like when Miley was collaborating with Future.
That song flopped too, I'll note.
Did flop, but I thought it was very good. I really liked it. And so I kind of like had this exhale moment where I was like, oh, this is over. This is actually over. And it's not over in the sense that Future begets Young Thug, and Young Thug begets like 100 different guys. And that basically, if you want to look at who the current generation of like 16 to 19 year old rappers emulate, it's either Thug or emulating Thug with a Future accent. So it's not that it's not relevant, but there's an exhaustion to Future right now. You know, Future and Thug just put out a tape and it just like disappeared without a – that's – if that had come out 18 months ago, that might have been like a Billboard top 5 record. I don't know where it's doing right now. Like, I mean,
it was close, but it just because it streamed a lot.
It's because it streamed, but it didn't have any tangible impact.
No.
And so listening to whatever Future verse was on the Spotify playlist, I was just like, oh, this is a commodity. This is a commodity product right now. And I think Taylor's choice is actually not looking at it as a commodity product, but to her, it's a slightly aggressive choice. She's not choosing to work with someone who would be, you know, it's not like a J. Cole verse or something.
It has more teeth than that.
Yes.
But
more teeth even than Kendrick.
I'd make the point that a Future feature has never been important outside of Racks.
Oh, like ever in life.
Yeah, I don't think he's a feature.
What about What a Time to Be Alive?
That's 50-50. I don't think he's a features artist, but I do think he likes the checks, because isn't there a Future verse?
I don't know. There's
Maroon 5
I will say
song?
Yes. Yes. Another.
So I think he's just on the market.
I will say there's a Future and Uncle Murda song that I really like, and the current Future and True Life song is very good.
Okay. I mean,
so maybe it's like a particular stripe of New York rapper.
He's done some hooks. I mean, Ring Ring with Rick Ross. We don't have to get into it. This doesn't have to be a future podcast. But, I just don't think future guest rap verses are a thing, really.
No, and again, it's sort of a...
She just wanted the tone and the vibe.
Yes. She wanted a rapper. Yeah. Yes. But again, wanted a rapper that would seem cool. Like, it's not Logic.
But I think
he's a bad boy. He's not.
Right. And as he says on the song. Yeah. And I think it comes, honestly, directly from the corporate partnership with Apple Music, where she sings Jumpman on the treadmill.
Mm-hmm. But it could still be Drake.
I agree, but that's why I said maybe Drake was busy.
I'm not even going to dignify that. Literally not even going to dignify that.
We know Drake is busy.
Drake's never too busy for Taylor. Okay, so then let's quickly tackle Hannah's other questions. I'm curious about the country music thing. Like, do I think that Taylor's going to end up at age 34 making a country record? Absolutely.
She'll be back.
Yeah. And like this thing where she like occasionally like emails Little Big Town like a number one record. Sure.
It's
like light work.
Is Better Man a top five Taylor Swift song of 2017?
Ooh. No.
Okay.
Do you think so?
I need a few more days with this album, but I think it's really strong.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Do you think Better Man is a better song if Taylor sings it?
Probably, yes.
Yeah. And I like Little Big Town, actually. I think especially like the last two albums have been really good. But I would say that I still am not 100% sold on the harmonies of Little Big Town.
But I think she'll be back, and I don't think she even needs to keep a foot in it to come back. I think she can go, she could make a grime album and then come back and make a country album, and they'd love
it. Her label is not moving. It's still in Nashville.
Taylor's not hot. Okay, so, and then the other question is, how does she actually stack up to other pop stars, and does she bring anything new to the table? And I think this is actually what I spent a lot of time thinking about was about Taylor vis-a-vis innovation. And her innovations, broadly speaking, and I'm not talking just on this album, her innovations, broadly speaking, are being slightly to the left or slightly outside of the space that you think she's in. So you think she's a country singer, but she's a little bit more than that. You think she's in the hybrid, she's actually an old-fashioned pop singer. You think she's like a retro pop singer, she's actually a modern. She keeps doing these like little strategic like leaps from one stone to the next. I don't know where it ends, but I don't see her as a innovator. Not in that way.
Her consistency-wise, I think that she's more successful than a lot of the other pop singers.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I don't want to turn this into an anti-Lady Gaga podcast, although I am happy to do that as well. But like, Joanna was such a turd this year. It was just so disappointing. And this Taylor album.
Tell them how you
like
feel, Karen.
I think we can all agree on this, right?
I don't know. Only one of us had to fly to Tacoma on a Saturday.
And Lady Gaga only tweeted angry things at one of us. It's true. If I had written it, I'm sure I would have gotten it done. But that album, it didn't innovate. It was like 10 steps. I don't even know what direction, but it was not in the right direction. And this album is so much more interesting.
Yeah.
There's so much more texture and feeling and it's more genuine, which is not a word I always use with Taylor. I'm trying to think of the other records this year.
But I mean, just even at her worst as a writer, Taylor is better than everyone else. I think.
Yes.
Just on a writing level.
I think that's accurate.
The way every song is a mashup is kind of innovative in its way. It's like those two parts don't go together, but they do.
She's going to make it. She's going to make it.
By the third listen, they do.
Although what's interesting, and again, I don't want to, in the same way you don't want to bash Lady Gaga the podcast, I don't want to bash the Chainsmokers the whole podcast. But if you listen to the structure of a lot of Chainsmokers records, they're not that different from the weird structural juxtapositions that are happening on these Taylor songs.
You think she just pulls it off better?
Yes, I think she pulls it off better.
They're more charming.
I also see Taylor's choices as like one principal choice followed by a second principal choice followed by a third followed by a fourth followed by a how many, whereas the Chainsmokers are like basically like, I know these three chords, if even.
My computer knows these three chords.
Yeah, right. Like, you know, Chainsmokers type record. They just like go on YouTube and like just see what's happening. So anyway.
Direct your tweets at John Caramonica.
Actually, I want to say, fans. Can I shout out the Chainsmokers though real fast? So they did a Reddit AMA and someone pointed this out to me on Twitter. One of the guys said that they read their reviews and that they take them seriously and that they had read what I had written about them and that it hurt, but that there are a lot of good points.
Huh.
Shouts to the Chainsmokers.
Yeah. Let us know if Taylor emails you.
Well, if Lady Gaga,
yeah. People have other ways. Yeah. Some people have some ways of expressing their pleasure or displeasure, and other people have other ways. Okay, let's go to Chantal Fernandez. So Chantal has a range of feelings. So Chantal does not like the songs. She's a longtime fan, but she does not like the songs. She said the music was smart and layered, even if it was ruthlessly commercial, but she's having trouble with getting into the new songs. However, she has a question about these potentially inflated album sales numbers. The fan program, where you can increase the chances of getting tickets if you buy the album or stream, does that something that you think is a gimmick to inflate sales numbers?
I think...
And is this a common practice? I don't think it's common.
Right.
I think the fan program that they're trying to pioneer is a little bit different than other people's.
Yeah, programs. So what Chantal is describing is a sort of Taylor Swift-specific customized deal with Ticketmaster called Verified Fan, in which you can do various things to boost your place in line to get concert tickets for this upcoming tour. Some of those things are buying more. So every time you buy the album or the associated magazines or et cetera, you get closer, allegedly, to being able to purchase tickets when they go on sale. You can also do things like tweet. There are things that are free, but I get the sense that the more money
really
you can spend,
yes,
the better. But I genuinely, maybe I'm naive, I genuinely think Team Taylor
would have showed up to buy anyway.
No, I think her management and, you know, the people who helped her come up with this really do think it will help real fans get the tickets instead of scalpers.
Right.
I think obviously there's class considerations built into it. But
you don't want to see like tickets on StubHub for $6.
Right.
You don't want to see that.
But I think it accomplishes both. I think it could be good for the fans, and also the sales numbers will go up because there will be those insane Taylor heads that will buy 10 copies of the album.
Taylor heads. Call them Swifties.
It's not a great term. Swifties.
Taylor,
you're right.
Just go home and tie-dye any Taylor shirt that you have, and you become a Taylor head. Okay, next question. Emily Hutchison. Emily wasn't sure how she felt about 2 out of the 4 new songs, but she's getting into the record now. Emily has sort of what feels to me maybe like a fire take, and it's, I would say, sort of akin to some other conversations we have had on the podcast about other artists. On the first podcast, meaning the last episode, you discussed the lower chart positions of these new Taylor songs compared to the last album. I wonder if this is Taylor in her Lemonade phase, not in terms of content, but in terms of approach. Slightly more experimental, for her anyway, leaning more heavily on being an antagonist through sound or subject matter, and ultimately less bothered about chart position. Final Lemonade/Reputation reflection. The 4 tracks Taylor released are sprinkled throughout the record. Maybe she released those 4 first because they summarize the journey of the whole album, which presumably reflects the journey she's been on the last few years. I like this tape.
Yeah, really good. Yeah.
I think it's good.
Does this person want an internship?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, for a job. Let us know where you're at in your schooling, Emily, or a professional career. I think this is a valid question. I think this is a valid question not just for Taylor. This is a valid question for anyone who has established fans.
Do you still need to be the
biggest? Is it important? If Z100 doesn't play your songs, if Hot 97 doesn't play your songs, does it matter? And I think what we've seen for Beyonce is that is not relevant. Maybe for other people it matters a little bit more.
I think for Taylor it does matter. I think they're very different kinds of artists.
Okay, so you do not, so you think this is just
the first part of it.
You dismiss it.
Well, not dismiss.
No, no, but you,
sorry,
but you're saying,
dear listener,
no,
I disagree.
But you disagree. That's yeah. Right. So you think that it's sort of basically Taylor wants to be as big as she's been in the past. The songs just aren't doing what she thinks they should be doing.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's really hard to compare Look What You Made Me Do and Formation just because just for all the obvious reasons.
A few reasons.
For all the obvious reasons.
Sure, someone's out there writing that thing piece.
But I have seen the term statement single being thrown around. Chris Malamphy, who is a friend of the podcast, wrote about this. That's at least the spin that we're getting now. There was a Billboard story that quoted some executives about this album rollout, and they said, you know, it's okay that basically that Look What You Made Me Do was number one for a week or two and then basically fell off the face of the planet because it accomplished what it needed to narratively. I think this will not be a successful Taylor Swift album unless there's a smash that lasts. Not artistically, but I think commercially, yeah. I think if I had to guess, I'd say they're counting on big hits.
Also, that first song doesn't have to be a radio song. That first song just has to say, I'm back, mm-hmm. which it did emphatically.
Yeah.
I think Getaway Car is going to be the big radio single. You heard it here first.
I think it's Delicate or Endgame are the big records.
All right, we'll come back to this.
I'm excited.
We'll make it interesting.
Okay, here's a question from Michael Eichner. Michael, are you related to Billy Eichner? What's up? Michael. So Michael came with the fire subject, and the subject is, did Taylor intentionally make a bad album? Now, I think, Michael, you've probably gathered by this point of the podcast that we think the album's pretty good. But I'm going to skip over the first paragraph and then go to the second paragraph, which I think kind of like illuminates your question a little bit more, which is, I also wonder, this is what you said, I also wonder whether the Reputation concept was too, for lack of a better word, edgy, in quotes, for Taylor to really embrace, given her current place in the pop music landscape and her audience, which, to my knowledge, still skews pretty young. Taylor was never going to write songs like, say, Tove Lo's Cool Girl. And that is probably true. That is probably true. In a weird way, though, I want to first answer this question from an aesthetics. If you look at the album art, this seems like a non-tough person's idea of what tough looks like. Like the Affliction font, the black and white. Like it's...
The hair's slicked back.
Yeah, this
is a shame,
like,
we couldn't get into any of this in your review, actually.
I actually have probably another 1,200 words just on the album art.
All right.
I'm going to Corey at Styles with that.
All right, the editor says. Skeptically.
It's true, though. I guess my reaction to this is, every concept is relative, right? Like, so I think for Taylor, that's what this is. But it's not, Taylor's not Rihanna. And no, she's not Tove Lo.
She's not bad. I mean, however many times she's going to tell us that,
but she did something
bad
on
this album, I just don't buy it. Just like I don't buy that she's chill.
Do you buy that she's slizz?
I buy that she has been drinking. But it's interesting to me that she's made this turn finally at age 27.
Yes.
You know, she could have made it legally many albums ago.
This is the age that rock stars used to die.
But
this is the age where Taylor decided to have her first old fashioned, which is also not a very badass drink.
I still believe the old fashioned belongs to someone else. I think somebody else ordered it.
Is it maybe somebody that...
Somebody,
you know,
British.
Someone who doesn't own her,
yeah,
but really knows her?
Oh. Yeah,
maybe.
Michael also just threw in a P.S. to let me know that his sister Ellen wants to know why I like Lil Peep, and that he did not like the Nothing Nowhere record. So shouts to you, Michael.
You and your sister,
Michael,
are wrong.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's cool.
Would you also like an internship, Michael?
You can work specifically for Karen.
Karen, we will talk to you. Okay, so we received a bunch of emails about Taylor and politics and political art, and how do you engage with artists who you either struggle with their politics or are unclear about their politics. We got a bunch of emails about that. So here's one representative one. This is a name I may not get right. Zane Pecky. So Zane, I'm sorry if I'm getting the last name wrong. So Zane wrote, I thought, a very thoughtful note about this. Zane writes, over the past year, it has become almost impossible for me to consume artwork without considering the ramifications of an artist's behavior. I am unable to view a Picasso without thinking of the women he abused. I cannot enjoy No Flockin' 2 without thinking of Kodak's assault and harassment.
Alleged.
Thank you, pop music reporter Joe Coscarelli, coming with the facts.
Not defending, just
no,
saying.
Just, no, just, that's yes. What facts are.
Yes. That's,
how could I possibly enjoy a Taylor Swift project when she has refused to denounce the Republican administration? My distaste for anyone not actively fighting those who identify as Republicans, in quotes, has grown this year. I have happily cut people from my life over their support of Republicans. In the past, it has been easy for me to deem artists, including XXXTentacion, Chris Brown, and G-Eazy, unlistenable. Why am I so reluctant to do so for Taylor? What did G-Eazy do?
G-Eazy.
I don't... Zane, drop me an email and tell me what G-Eazy did. I don't know. Besides using too much hair gel, I'm not sure. Why am I so reluctant to do so for Taylor? Am I holding her to an unrealistic standard by demanding she enrage the white Americans who vote Republican and purchase her albums? Supporting an abuser is clearly wrong, but what about supporting someone who has thus far indirectly supported the most powerful abuser of them all? Should I just shut up and enjoy that sweet, sweet auto-tune? This is a real...
This could be a whole podcast.
Can I... Yeah. Karen, do we have the budget to fly everybody here to have like a
round table?
Yeah, to have like a big session. Okay, first of all, I love every question that we've got.
Yeah.
This, I found, again, the sort of the emotional acuity of this, I thought, was very, very sharp. And it's something that I know I struggle with as a critic. There is also, with being a critic, the additional responsibility of responding to artwork that is made by problematic people. You can't actually, I mean, it has been argued that you could ignore it, but when something is out in the world and having a huge impact, it's hard to ignore it, especially if your job is in part to address what's happening in the world. Obviously, this feels like a personal choice as far as what you can support or not support. But I think that what you've seen with the silence of Taylor in the last 12 months or more, really.
18 months.
Yeah. Is you're starting to see a generation of fans and a social and cultural moment that no longer has room or tolerance for such silence.
I think that email was very representative of the way a lot of people feel.
Yes. I think this is a valid position to have. And I think when I think about potential risk points for Taylor in the future, this feels like a risk point. Like playing it so safe and being so shut off to this particular. And again, it's, I don't know if this would have been true 5 or 10 years ago, but we are living in a social and political moment where you stand on these issues is part of how people see you. It's part of how people judge you. And I think Taylor making a, I presume, extremely conscious choice to avoid that is maybe betting that this moment will pass, or alternately, to go back to what I wrote about 1989, living in a world where maybe these issues are not as pressing, or she feels are not as pressing in her life, that doesn't change the broader questions, though.
Well, that kind of makes for like the Jimmy Fallon of pop. You know, it doesn't fit into her vibe. It doesn't fit into what she likes to discuss. So I don't think she'll suffer the way that he did. You know, his ratings started to slip when he wasn't addressing what's happening in our government. I think it dings her popularity a little bit.
I will say, I don't know if I expected, but I was open to the possibility that in listening to this album, you would get something that you could interpret as being vaguely political,
even if it was largely
nonpartisan or just about unity or whatever it may be. I don't hear that on this album. I agree that it was a conscious choice. I think Taylor, from listening to this album and just reading about her and her fans, I think she does feel like she's held to a different standard than people, and that she is attacked by the media and by haters, and that however she expressed herself on this issue, she might come in for criticism. So that she could,
that
she can't win here.
But you also can't win for avoiding.
Totally. But I think that her strategy to this point has been guided by this belief that there's no right answer for her in this predicament. And I don't know if I believe that to be true, but I believe that that's her position.
And maybe Taylor would like to return to a time before questions like this were part of her day-to-day life. So maybe let's close with probably the platonic old Taylor song on the new record, which is New Year's Day.
There's glitter on the floor after the party. Girls carrying the shoes down in the lobby. Candle wax and Polaroids on the hardwood floor.
That's our show this week. Thank you to my guests, John Perales, Joe Coscarelli, and Karen Gans. And honestly, thank you to everyone who wrote in. We didn't get to all the questions. We got to a lot of them. Every time I read our email account, I'm consistently blown away by not only your enthusiasm for pop music and your enthusiasm for what we're doing here on the podcast, but also the perspective that you guys bring and forcing me and engaging me to think about things in ways that even I haven't gotten to yet. And I'm always grateful for it. So thank you for that. Every podcast ever is archived at nytimes.com/podcast. And if you have a long weekend, or maybe you're feeling bad about things that are happening in the world, or maybe you just need a break from listening to Reputation, you should go listen to a bunch of them. We are also available on Google Play and iTunes and Stitcher and the iHeartRadio app and places where people get audio content. So go get that audio content. You can email us. A lot of you have, and you should keep emailing us. podcast@nytimes.com. I may even figure out how to get it on my phone one of these days. Thanks to our producer, Pedro Rosado of Head Separate Media, who's been incredibly flexible and maybe not as excited about Taylor Swift as we are, but certainly game for what we've been pulling off this week. Extremely tolerant. So shouts to Pedro for being flexible in the last few days, and we will be back next week.
Hold on to the memories, they will hold on to you. And I will hold on to you. Please.
stranger whose laugh I could recognize anyway.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.